terrifying. She's afraid of the fear. They are in 1G by definition, but the Voyagers decide, and the records in the computers they brought down with them confirm, that they were living in something close to 1.1G for most of their voyage home. Why the ship did this, they cannot determine from the records they have. Freya says to Badim, "It must have done it to make sure we felt light when we got here."
"Yes, I guess that's possible. I suppose. But I wonder, too, if there was some programming done by the people in year 68. Some kind of alteration that left the ship with no frame of reference. We can ask it when it comes around the sun."
Ah, that's the source of her fear. One of them, anyway. There may be more. There may be many. But that one stabs her in the heart. Has it reached the sun yet?
Almost.
A lighter 1G or not, Badim is showing the effects of something. Of being on Earth, he says. He jokes that their bodies are oxidizing faster in this world, the real world. He is stiffer, slower.
"The truth is," he says to Freya when she expresses concern, "depending on how you count it, I am now some 235 years old."
"Please, Bibi, don't put it that way, or else we're all too old to live. You were asleep 150 of those years, remember that?"
"Asleep, yes. But how should we prorate those years? We count the time we sleep, usually, when we give our age. We don't say, 'I've been alive 60 years and asleep 20 years. We say, "I'm 80 years old."
"And so you are, and a very healthy 80 at that. You look like you could be 50. He laughs at this, pleased with her lie. Or pleased with her lying. Then their ship has reached the sun, and Freya, heart filled with fear, asks their minders to show them what they can. The minders put images on a big screen in a large room where all of them who want to can gather. Not everyone wants to face it together, but most do. And indeed, as the minutes pass, almost all the ones who said they wanted to be alone or with family, come creeping out to join the big group. The screen is showing images of the sun. They sit there in a darkened room, looking at it. It's hard to breathe. The image of the sun is filtered down to a simple orange ball, marred by a scattering of black sunspots. The image on the screen shifts. The sunspots jump to a new position, possibly this present moment. The predicted time of their ship's transit behind the sun is just over 3 days, and now that time is almost over. They sit there in that no time, in which one can't say whether time is passing or not. Maybe it was like that when they were hibernating. Maybe now they have the ability to get back into that mind when pushed that way. It's too long. No one can say how long it is, or remember how long it's supposed to take, or sense how long it feels. Freya is feeling sick now, obscurely aware that there is perhaps a rocking of this immense ship that is impacting her, even though she can't quite feel it. Many look like they're feeling the same. Ungodly edge of nausea, the feeling she hates most of all, worse than the sharpest pain, queasy dread. Like others, she staggers off to go to the bathroom, walks around the halls to make the time pass, feeling the dread squeeze her insides harder and harder. Then a line of minute white particulates emerges from the right edge of the solar mass on the screen, like a meteor that has broken up, like a brief shimmer of the aurora borealis, and she sits down on the floor. Badim is beside her, holding her. Around her is everyone she's ever known, all stunned and holding each other. They are stunned. Freya looks at Badim. He shakes his head.
They're gone.
She leaves that moment, that place. Badim and Aram share a sad glance. Another conflagration of mice, going up in flames by the tens of thousands,
as they have a want to do. All the animals likewise. And Yoki. And the ship. It spawned them in its last days like a salmon, Aram says. Have to hold to that thought.
Poor Yoki. My boy.
Aram wipes his eyes over and over. Their minders are solicitous. They tell them that their ferry included a computer with 10 zettabytes of memory, which may include good backups, may constitute a viable copy of their ship's AI. Badim shakes his head at them as they say this.
It was a quantum computer.
Badim explains gently, as if breaking the news of a death to a child.
It was not reducible to its records.
A coldness comes over Freya, a kind of calm. So much has died. They made it back. They are home for the first time. But this place is not their home. She sees that now. They will always be exiles here, on a world too big to believe. Indeed, it seems best to stick to disbelief for a while, stay in that disconnect. The intermittences of the heart being what they are, the feel of things will come back eventually. And that will be soon enough. They are taken to Hong Kong, and a couple of weeks later, their township anchors offshore from it. A harbor city as big as a dozen or 20 of their biomes stitched together, and filled with many skyscrapers, quite a bit taller than any biome, taller than a spoke, possibly taller than the spine. It's hard to keep any sense of perspective against the sky. The day before it was cloudy, and the flat gray cloud looked like an immense roof over the visible world. Aram says those clouds were 3 kilometers high, and now he and Badim are arguing about how high the clear blue sky appears to be.
You mean if it was a dome?
Badim points out.
Of course, but it looks like one,
Aram says.
At least to me. I know it's a scattering of sunlight, but doesn't it look like a solid dome? I think it does. Just look at it. It's much like a biome ceiling.
He and Badim have taken to consulting a book they found on their wrist pads, an ancient text called The Nature of Light and Color in the Open Air. And now they pore over a section called Apparent Flattening of the Vault of Heaven, which confirms Aram's contention that the sky can be perceived as a dome.
See, Aram says, pointing at his wrist pad. The top of the sky looks lower to the viewer than the horizon is distant to him, by a factor ranging from 2 to 4, it says, depending on the observer and the viewing conditions. Does that seem right to you?
Badim peers up and out the open doorway to the upper deck. He and Aram walk out on this upper deck all the time, unconcerned by the exposure.
It does. And this explains why these skyscrapers look so tall, perhaps, as the writer goes on to say that we tend to think the midway point of the arc between horizon and zenith is at a 45-degree angle to the ground, as it would be if the dome were a hemisphere. But with the dome being lower than the horizon is far away, the midway point of the arc is angled much lower, say around 12 to 25 degrees. So we consistently think things are higher than they are. Well, but I think also that these skyscrapers are just stupendously tall. No doubt, but we're seeing them even taller than they are. Show me what you mean.
They put on sunscreen, hats, and sunglasses, and go out on the open upper deck of the great township and turn in circles, putting their hands out at the sky and chattering as they peer at their wrist pads. They seem to be adjusting very well to the new world and to the death of their lifelong home, of Yoki, their lost guest. Freya still feels stunned, and she cannot yet even stand before the windows, nor do more than glance out the big open doorway between her and them. And the idea of going outside onto the deck with them
is enough to knock her into a chair. A black emptiness fills her right to the skin. Many of Hong Kong's buildings emerge from the water of the city's bay, a result no doubt of the big sea level rise, which some of her shipmates now claim to have read about or seen in the feed. But now it's here below them, in the canals that thread between all the buildings closest to water, and the long, narrow boats grumbling airily past them, leaving in their wakes a slosh of waves and smell of salt and burnt cooking oil. Cry of wheeling gulls. Hot, humid, reeking. If any of their tropical biomes had felt as hot and humid as this, had smelled like this, they would have been sure something had gone wrong. Behind all the skyscrapers are green hills, dotted everywhere with buildings. They're still looking around at all this tremendous landscape when they are taken off their township, led into a long, low ferry. It's kind of like moving in a tram from one biome to another. No need to go outside the long cabin of the ferry, but Freya's in a panic at the thought that she may have to. She's been provided with boots that come up to just above her knees, and these seem to give her more support and balance than she's been used to. She still can't feel her feet, but as she walks, the boots seem to know what she is trying for, and with some care, she can walk pretty well. Then up a tubular walkway, somewhat like one of their spoke interiors, then into an elevator car, then out into a room that opens out all along one wall to another open deck, located apparently some hundreds of meters above the bay. Up there in the sky, just under an inrush of low clouds, the marine layer, as Badim calls it. Whose idea was this? Now the people of the ship are going out onto the open deck and very often falling down, many weeping or crying out, many going back inside the room to seek shelter. Freya huddles by the elevator. The starship's people see her there and come over and hug her, and some of their hosts are laughing, others crying. All presumably moved to see people who have never been outdoors try to come to terms with it.
They are like the winter lambs, some translation box says, let out of the barn in the spring. A lot of their legs are messed up. Come on, get them back inside, the same box and voice says. You're going to kill them with this stuff.
The box's voice has a Terran accent, speaks English harshly and with a lot of tonal bounce, as if, Badim says, English were Chinese. Hard to understand. Crying with embarrassment and frustration, feeling her face burn red, Freya breaks from her crowd and staggers on her new boots right out the open doorway wall, out onto the open deck, keeping her eyes squeezed nearly shut. Feeling faint, she walks to a chest-high wall with a railing on its top, something she can grasp like a lifeline. She stands there in the wind and opens her eyes and looks around, her stomach like a black hole inside her, pulling her in. Sun incandescing through the clouds low overhead.
That's a mackerel sky, says a translation box. Nice pattern, warp and weft. Might rain tomorrow.
Oh my God, someone is saying over and over. And then she feels in her mouth that it's her saying it. She stops herself with a fist in her mouth, hangs on to the railing with her other hand. She can see so far, she can't focus on it. She closes her eyes, clenches the railing hard with both hands, keeps her eyes closed so she won't throw up. She needs to get back into the room, but is afraid to walk. She will fall, crawl back desperately afraid everyone will see it. She's stuck there, and so she puts her forehead down on the railing, tries to relax her stomach. She feels Badim's hand on her shoulder.
It's okay.
Not really. After a while, she says, I wish Devi could have seen this. She would have liked it more than me.
Yes.
Badim sits on the deck beside her, his back against the retaining wall. His face is tilted to the sky.
Yes, she would have liked this.
It's so big.
I know.
I'm afraid I'm going to be sick.
Do you want to move back from the edge?
I don't think I can move yet. What we can see from here,
waving briefly at the bay and ocean, the hills, the skyscraper city springing up around them, the glare of the sun slanting through the clouds.
Just what we can see from here, right now, is bigger than our whole ship.
That's right.
I can't believe it.
Believe?
But we were in a toy.
Yes. Well, it had to be as small as they thought would work, so they could push it to a good interstellar speed. It was a case of conflicting priorities, so they did what they could.
I can't believe they thought it would be okay.
Well, do you remember that time you told Devi that you wanted to live in your dollhouse, and she said you already did?
No, I don't think so.
Well, she did. She got really mad.
Oh, that brings it back. That time she got mad.
Badim laughs. Freya slides down beside him and laughs too. Badim puts his hands under his sunglasses, wipes tears from his eyes.
Yes,
he says.
She got mad a lot.
She did, but I guess I never really knew why until now.
Badim nods. He keeps his hands under his glasses, over his eyes.
She didn't either. Not really. She never saw this, so she didn't really know. But now we know. I'm glad. She would be glad too.
Freya tries to see her mother's face, hear her voice. She can still do it. Devi is still there, especially her voice. Her voice, the ship's voice, Yuen's voice, Yoki's voice. All the voices of her dead. Yuen on Aurora, loving the wind as it knocked him around. She reaches up and grabs the railing, pulls herself up, and stares down at the great city. She holds on for dear life. She's never felt sicker. They're put on a train to Beijing. They ride in broad plush seats on the upper story of two long cars, linked like two biomes by a passageway. They constitute a moving party, with windows and skylight domes and the land flowing past them, flat and green, hilly and brown, on and on and on and on.
Never have we moved so fast, someone exclaims.
It is indeed astounding how quickly the train moves over the landscape. It's going 500 kilometers per hour, one of their hosts tells them. Aram and Badim confer. Aram smiles briefly and shakes his head. Badim laughs and says to the others,
"For most of our lives, we were moving 1 million times faster than this."
They cheer themselves. They laugh at the craziness of it. As the train glides with its startling rapidity over this impossibly big world, day turns to night by way of the most lurid sunset they have yet seen. Fuchsia clouds blazing in a pale sky that is lemon over the black horizon, bending into green above that. Then higher still, a blue some say is called cyan blue. And over that, an indigo that spreads all the way over their skylight to the east. All these intense transparent colors are there at once, and yet none of their Terran hosts are taking the slightest notice. They are all watching the screens on their wrists, screens that sometimes exhibit tiny images of the Voyagers. They can scroll for themselves on their wrist pads and see what people are saying about them. But it's disturbing to do so, because then they see and hear how much resentment, contempt, anger, and violent hatred is directed at them. Apparently, to many people, they are cowards and traitors. They have betrayed history, betrayed the human race, betrayed evolution, betrayed the universe itself. How will the universe know itself? How will consciousness expand? They have let down not just humanity, but the universe. Freya turns off her wrist pad.
Why? She asks Badim. Why do they hate us so?
He shrugs.
He too is troubled.
People have ideas. They live in their ideas, do you understand? And those ideas, whatever they happen to be, make all the difference.
But there's more than ideas, she protests. This world.
She gestures at the fading sunset.
It's not just our ideas.
For some people it is. They don't have anything else, maybe, so they give everything they have to ideas.
She shakes her head, still upset.
I would hate that. I would hate to be that way.
She gestures at the tiny angry faces on the other screens, faces still there on the wrists around them, imp faces, literally spitting in the intensity of their bitterness.
I hope they'll leave us alone.
They'll forget us soon enough. For now, we're the new thing, but another new thing will come. And people like that need fresh fuel for their fire.
Aram frowns as he overhears this. It isn't clear, he agrees. In Beijing, they are guided to a rectangular building the size of a couple of biomes, a compound, they call it, surrounding a central courtyard that is mostly paved but holds also a few short trees. The whole ship's population can be fitted into rooms clustered at one corner of this compound, which must therefore house 4,000 or 5,000 people. And it is only one building, in a city that goes to the horizon in all directions, a city in which the train, slowing down as it approached, took 4 hours to get to this central area. Next day, many of them are taken to Tiananmen Square. Freya does not go. The day after, they are taken on a tour of the Forbidden City, home of the ancient Chinese emperors. Again, Freya cannot face going out. Many are like her. When the others come back, they say the buildings appeared both ancient and shining, as if new, so that it was hard to understand them as objects. Freya wishes she had seen that. Their Chinese hosts speak to them in English and seem happy to be hosting them, which is reassuring after all the venomous little faces on the screens. The Chinese want the starfarers to like their city. They are proud of their city. Meanwhile, clouds and a yellow haze thicken the air and keep the sky from being too overwhelming to Freya. She stays in rooms and pretends the world outside is a larger room, or that she is in some kind of projection. Possibly she can hold to this feeling all the time. She feels she has faced the worst, perhaps, although she still stays indoors and away from windows, too. Several of the starfarers, this is what the Chinese call them, nevertheless collapse in the next few days, overwhelmed either physically or mentally, if there is any difference. Their tours are abruptly canceled, and they are all moved to some kind of medical facility, one as big as their compound, either emptied for their arrival or unused, hard to say. Not much is ever explained to them. And some of them suspect they are now pawns in a game they don't understand. But others are not worried about anything but themselves and their shipmates, because people are falling apart. The Chinese want to run tests on all of them, as they are worried for their guests. 4 have died since they landed. Many are disabled either from their hibernation or the descent from space. Many more are not coping with Earth very well, one way or another. Miserable faces, scared faces, all these faces she has known all her life, the only faces she has ever known, her people. It isn't how Freya imagined it. She herself is miserable.
What is this? She says to Badim. What's happening to us? We made it.
He shrugs.
We're exiles. The ship is gone, and this is not our world. So all we have is each other, and that, we know already, never made us particularly happy or secure. And being outdoors is scary.
I know it. I'm the worst of all.
She has to admit it.
But I don't want to be. I'm going to get used to it.
You will,
Badim says.
You will if you want to. I know you will.
But when she approaches a window, when she nears a door, her heart slams in her chest like a child trying to escape. That vault of sky, those distant clouds, the unbearable sun. She grinds her teeth, she gnashes her teeth, and strides to the windows and smashes her nose into the glass and looks out, hands on her chest, sweating and gnashing her teeth, to look out at the visible world until her pulse slows. And her pulse never slows. Days pass. They huddle miserably together. Aram and Badim, worried though they are about things outside Freya's ken, continue to sit next to each other and watch the screens and chat about what they see and observe their comrades curiously. If it were up to them alone, all would be well. They are having an adventure, their old faces say. They are having the time of their lives. Above all, they remain deeply surprised. Freya takes heart from seeing their faces. She sits at Badim's feet, pressed against his bony shins, looking up at him, trying to relax. The two old friends often read to each other, as of old during the evenings in the Fetch, that lovely little town. And one day, Aram, reading his wrist silently, chuckles and says to Badim, "Here, listen to this. A poem by a Greek who lived in Alexandria. One Kafavi. You said, I shall go to another land, to another sea. Another city will be found better than this. My every effort is a written indictment, and my heart, like the dead, is buried. How long will my mind be in this decay?" And so on like that. It's the same old song we know so well. If only I were somewhere else, I would be happy. Until the poet replies to his poor friend, "New lands you will not find. You won't find other seas. The city will follow you. The streets you roam will be the same. There is no boat for you. There is no street. In the same way your life you destroyed here, in this petty corner, you have spoiled it in the entire universe."
Badim smiles, nods.
"I remember this poem. I read it to Devi one time, to remind her not to pin all her hopes on Aurora, not to wait for our arrival before she started to live. We were young at the time, and she was most seriously annoyed with me, I can tell you. But that translation doesn't sound right to me. I think there is a better one."
And he taps on one of the tablets left for them to use.
"Here it is," he says. "I remembered right. I ran across the poem in the quartet. Listen, this is Durell's translation. You tell yourself, I'll be gone. To some other land, some other sea. To a city lovelier far than this. Could ever have been or hoped to be. Where every step now tightens the noose. A heart in a body. Buried and out of use. See, he rhymes it." "I'm not sure I like that,"
Aram says.
"No, but the meaning is the same, and the payoff is here at the end. There's no new land, my friend, no. New sea, no other places, always this. Your earthly landfall, and no ship exists to take you from yourself. Ah, don't you see? Just as you've ruined your life in this one plot of ground, you've ruined its worth everywhere now. Over the whole earth."
Aram nods.
"Ah, yes. That's good."
They tap around for a while longer, reading silently. Then Aram says,
"Look, I've found another version. A Martian one, it seems. Listen to this end. Ah, don't you see? Since your mind is the prison, you'll live behind bars, everywhere now, over all of Mars."
"Very nice," Badim says. "That's us, all right. We are trapped in a prison of our own devise."
"Horrible," Freya protests. "What do you mean nice? It's horrible. And we didn't trap ourselves. We were born in prison."
"But we're not
there now,
Badim says, eyeing her closely. She is sitting at his feet, as she has so often before.
And we are always ourselves, no matter where we go. That's what the poem is saying, I think. We have to recognize it and make what we can here. This world, great as it is only just another biome we have to live in.
I know that, Freya says. I'm fine with that, no problem at all. Just don't be blaming us. Devi was right. We lived our lives in a fucking closet. It's like we were kidnapped as children and locked away by some madman. Now that we're out, I plan to enjoy it.
Badim nods, eyes shining as he regards her. Good girl. You do that. You'll teach us again.
I will. Although her stomach knots as she says it. The unbearable sun, the vertigo sky, reeling around sick with fear, how to face it? How to walk at all in such a sky, with such bad legs, such a fearful heart?
Badim puts an arm around her shoulders as he sees her face. She presses her face against his knees and weeps.
He is so old. He is aging fast, oxidizing before her eyes. She can't bear to lose him. She fears she will lose him. She has lost so much. She fears her huge, uncontrollable fear.
The Chinese get her fitted with new knee-high boots that act according to her wishes, taking signals from her nervous system and translating them into walking that is not unlike what she would have done if she could feel her feet. It's almost as if her own sensations have been transferred out into her shoes, while her actual feet remain as numb as shoes used to be. It's a switch that takes some getting used to, but is much preferable to staggering around and falling, or pushing a walker, or swinging over crutches. She strides around in these new boots, trying to get used to them. Already she's become accustomed to the strangely lighter 1G of Terran gravity. Almost. They get invited to send a delegation to some kind of conference about starships, and Aram and Badim ask Freya if she would like to join them. They look concerned. They don't seem to be sure she can handle it. But here, as so often in the ship, she sees that they want to use her as some kind of Devi surrogate or ceremonial figurehead, some kind of public face for their group. And she also understands suddenly that Badim feels he has to ask her whether or not he thinks it's a good idea for her to join them. Yes, she says, annoyed. And soon, they are flying to North America, a group of 22 of them, chosen awkwardly, in a subdued, distracted manner, not their usual town hall style. They're confused. It isn't obvious how to decide things anymore. They're not in their world. They don't know what to do. Possibly the ship used to run their meetings more than they realized. Who knows? But now, they are in disarray. Looking down occasionally from the rocket plane's little window, she sees the great blue world rolling below them. In this case, the Arctic Ocean, they are told. Earth is a water world, no doubt about it. Not unlike Aurora in that respect. Perhaps it's that which adds to the feeling of dread welling up in her. Perhaps it's dread of the topic of the meeting they are headed toward, given what the faces on the screens keep saying about them, given everything that has happened. Their Chinese hosts have promised to fly them back to their fellow starfarers any time they want to go, promised that no one will ever keep them apart, assuming they want to stay together. They are world citizens now, the Chinese say. Thus, Chinese citizens, among all their other citizenships, and they have carte blanche to go where they want, do what they want. The Chinese offer a permanent home, and whatever work the starfarers care to do. The Chinese are hard to understand. It isn't clear why they are doing what they are for the starfarers. But given the vituperation on the screens, the people of the ship can't help but feel relieved. Even if they are somehow pawns in a game they don't understand, or even see. It's better than the dripping scorn.
the spray of contempt. Badim looks tired. Freya wishes he had stayed in Beijing, but he refused. He wants to be there for this, to help her. The cobalt sheen of the Arctic winkles with a curving pattern of white lines, waves extending horizon to horizon under them. They seem to be flying very slowly, though they are informed the plane is moving at least 6 times faster than the train from Hong Kong to Beijing. Of course, now they're 20 kilometers above the earth instead of 20 meters. They can see so far that the horizon is faintly curved. They can see again that this world is a sphere. Coming south, they can see the real Greenland on their left. Not at all green, just as they had heard, but rather a waste of black mountains, with a central sea of white ice largely covered by melt pools of sky blue, a melange hard to grasp as a landscape. South again over the drowned coastline of eastern North America, deeply embayed by long blue arms of ocean, looking empty until just before they land, when buildings reappear under them in a profusion, in a dull city bright and geometrical, and they land on a point next to another forest of silver skyscrapers. Rooms and vehicles, vehicles and rooms. Crowded narrow streets and canals, buildings tall on both sides. Faces in the street staring at their cars, some of them shouting things. Nothing like Beijing, more like the screens. Here people speak English, and despite the accents, it's easy to understand what is being said. It's the starfarer's own language. Seems like it should be their world too, but obviously not. Here the sky seems taller than ever. Badim and Aram discuss this phenomenon, consulting their old book and its equations as they stare up between the buildings, ignoring the clear fact that the sky is shocking not for its height as a dome, but precisely because it is not a dome. This is what is so frightening about it. But they persist in their conversation, perhaps to hold off that fact. Now as they tram through the city, the sky overhead is a ceiling of patterned clouds that Aram says is to be called a herringbone sky, beautiful in the slant of afternoon light, low over them, although not as low as the rain clouds that amazed them in Hong Kong.
Is a herringbone sky the same as a mackerel sky?
I don't know. They punch around on their wrist pads trying to find out. Into a building as big as a biome. The Terrans themselves don't actually spend much time outside, Freya thinks. Maybe they too are terrified. Maybe the proper response to standing on the side of a planet in the open air of its atmosphere, very near to the local star, is always terror. Maybe everything humans ever did or planned to do was designed to dodge that terror. Maybe their plan to go to the stars was just one more expression of that terror. As she is still clutched over that terror, which continues to collapse her stomach whenever she is so close to being outdoors, this idea makes a lot of sense to her. Then she is back in a building, moving through room after hallway after room, talking to stranger after stranger. There are so many of them. Some have devices they aim at her as they shout questions. She ignores these and tries to focus on faces that look nice, that will make eye contact with her rather than look at their devices. They sit in a room that is some kind of waiting room, with tables covered with food and drink. They are soon to make a public appearance of some kind. Word comes through their wrist pads from their Chinese hosts that 4 more of their group back in Beijing have died. Causes of death unknown. Among the 4 is Delwyn. Before she fully understands what Aram and Badim and the others are saying about this and about the meeting's purpose, all mixing up in her now, she is led up on stage before a crowd and a bank of cameras. There are 12 people on stage. A moderator is asking questions. Badim and Aram flank her, along with Hester and Tao, and they sit and listen to what she slowly gathers is a discussion of the latest starship proposals. She leans against Badim to whisper in his ear, "More starships?" He nods, keeping his eyes on the speakers. The current plan, with prototypes being built in the asteroid belt, is to send out many small starships carrying hibernating passengers, who will sleep while the ships make their way out to all the 100 closest stars that have been identified to have Earth-like planets in their habitable zone. Not just Earth twins, but Earth analogs. These stars range from 27 to 300 light-years away. Probes have already passed through several of these systems, or will in the near future, and are sending back their data, and everything looks very promising. The people describing this plan get up one at a time from a bank of chairs on the other side of the speaker's podium, go to the podium, and tell their part of the story, with big images on a screen behind them always changing, after which they then sit back down. They are all men, all Caucasian, most bearded, all wearing jackets. One speaker among them introduces the others, and he then stands to the side and listens to their presentations, quizzically, his head tilted to one side, tugging at his beard, a small smile playing under his mustache. He nods at everything the others say, as if he has already thought their thought and now approves its articulation. He is very satisfied with the way this event is going. He stands after another speaker has finished, says to the crowd,
"You see, we'll keep trying until it works. It's a kind of evolutionary pressure. We've known for a long time that Earth is humanity's cradle, but you're not supposed to stay in your cradle forever."
He is obviously very pleased with the cleverness of this aphorism. He invites Aram to speak, the curious smirk twisting his face as he makes a magnanimous gesture. He is allowing Aram to speak. Aram stands at the podium, looks around at the audience.
"No starship voyage will work," he says abruptly. "This is an idea some of you have, which ignores the biological realities of the situation. We from Tau Ceti know this better than anyone. There are ecological, biological, sociological, and psychological problems that can never be solved to make this idea work. The physical problems of propulsion have captured your fancy, and perhaps these problems can be solved. But they are the easy ones. The biological problems cannot be solved, and no matter how much you want to ignore them, they will exist for the people you send out inside these vehicles. The bottom line is the biomes you can propel at the speeds needed to cross such great distances are too small to hold viable ecologies. The distances between here and any truly habitable planets are too great, and the differences between other planets and Earth are too great. Other planets are either alive or dead. Living planets are alive with their own indigenous life, and dead planets can't be terraformed quickly enough for the colonizing population to survive the time in enclosure. Only a true Earth twin, not yet occupied by life, would allow this plan to work. And these may exist somewhere. The galaxy, after all, is big. But they are too far away from us. Viable planets, if they exist, are simply too far away."
Aram pauses for a moment to collect himself. Then he waves a hand and says more calmly,
"That's why you aren't hearing from anyone out there. That's why the great silence persists. There are many other living intelligences out there, no doubt, but they can't leave their home planets any more than we can, because life is a planetary expression and can only survive on its home planet."
"But why do you say that?"
the moderator interrupts to ask, head cocked to the side.
"You're arguing a general law from your own particular case. That's a logical error. There are really no physical impediments to moving out into the cosmos. So eventually it will happen, because we are going to keep trying. It's an evolutionary urge, a biological imperative, something like reproduction itself. Possibly it may resemble something like a dandelion or a thistle releasing its seeds to the winds, so that most of the seeds will float away and die. But a certain percentage will take hold and grow, even if it's only 1%, that's success. And that's how it will be with us.
Freya finds herself standing up, and briefly she has to attend to her balance, to keep from falling on her face in front of them all. Then she is striding across the stage. Then she strikes the moderator in the face, and down he goes. She falls on him and smashes through his raised arms with both fists, trying to get another good blow in, pummeling furiously, shouting something in a painful roar. She doesn't even know what she's trying to say, doesn't know she's roaring. She catches him hard, right on the nose. Yes. And then Badim has her by one arm and Aram by the other. And others are there too, holding her, shouting. And she can't struggle too much without hurting Badim, who is shouting,
Freya, quit it. Freya, stop. Stop, stop. Stop, stop.
Uproar. Bedlam. Badim wrapping her, not letting go. They are escorting her off the stage. She's staggering. Aram ahead of them. One person standing in a doorway as if to block them. And Aram removing him by rushing at the man and shouting ferociously in the man's face, which causes the man to leap to the side. The sight of this shocks Freya. Lagging so far behind the moment, she is still wishing she could get one more good blow in. Hit the smirk itself. Kill that idiot smirk. But it's bizarre to see Aram shout like that. She twists in Badim's grasp and shouts something back at the meeting room. But again, she doesn't know what she's saying. It's just something bursting out of her, like a scream. After that, they're in trouble. She's in trouble. Their group locks her in with them and claims diplomatic immunity. Whatever that is in this case, no one can be sure. But it appears that it buys them some time. The authorities are a little unsure how to proceed, unsure enough for arguments to be made. Apparently, the man she assaulted does not wish to press charges, is assuring everyone he understands post-traumatic stress disorder, and besides only slipped and fell. But in cases of assault and battery, the wishes of the victim are not the main consideration, they are told, so diplomatic immunity may be their best defense. That, or just the sheer uncertainty of their legal status at any time. They are aliens or something. Freya is too upset to follow the arguing. Anyway, for now, no one is allowed into their rooms. Discussions go on out in the hallways outside. Freya manages to sleep through a lot of it, but her right hand hurts, and in a dull way she feels a little ashamed, a little crazy, though she also still wants one more poke. They are now persona non grata, Aram says to Badim after one of the hallway sessions, almost everywhere. Badim, looking older than ever, holds his head in his hands when he is not holding her hand. She sits there staring at a window she dare not approach.
Why did you do it?
He asks her.
Oh, never mind. I know why you did it. He was a fool, annoying as fools are. But there are always fools, Freya. People like him will always exist, and they don't matter, don't you see? They just don't matter. Fools will always be with us. You have to leave them to it and find your own way.
But they hurt people, Freya protests. She hasn't stopped feeling sick from the moment they pulled her off the poor man. She still wants that last punch, at the same time that she has doubled over with remorse. It isn't just foolish, it's sick. Did you hear what he said? Dandelion seeds? 99% sent out to die as part of the plan? Die a miserable death they can't prevent, children and animals and ship and all. And all for a stupid idea someone has? A dream? Why have that dream? Why are they that way?
People live in ideas, Badim says again. You can't stop it. We all live in ideas. You have to let these people have their ideas.
But they kill people with them.
I know, I know. It's always been that way. But look, people volunteer to get on these ships. There are waiting lists.
Their kids don't volunteer?
No. But it's still not our job to stop them.
Isn't it? Are you sure?
At this, he looks uncertain.
He takes her point, unhappily.
That they might be obliged to witness. That they are the survivors of one of these mad plans. She shakes her head, snares him with her look, as she so often has before.
Were the people who believed in eugenics just fools? I think we have to try to stop them.
Badim looks at her for a long time. He is really looking ancient now. She can't remember how he looked when she was a child. He pats her shoulder, and several times he almost speaks, then stops himself.
Well, he says finally, your mother would be proud of you.
After that, he can't speak for a while. Then,
you are reminding me of her. It's almost nice to see, but not, because I don't want you to die too from trying to do the impossible. Because look, you can't stop other people from pursuing their projects, their dreams. Even if they are crazy dreams, even if they won't work, if people want to do it, they will. Then later their children will suffer, sure. We can point that out, and we will. But it's everyone who has to stop these people. All of us together. It has to be an idea that fails, that no one will act on because no one believes it anymore. That may take a while. And meanwhile, listen to me. Kick the world, break your foot. And your feet, my girl, are already broken.
They have to get out of town. Aram arranges that somehow, a flight back to Beijing, where the Chinese are apparently not interested in extraditing Freya and Badim for a crime of this sort. Some are calling it free speech, decrying the sort of state that would prosecute free speech. Let people defend themselves from unarmed assaults, please. Why is it anyone else's business? Badim shakes his head at this line of reasoning, but says nothing. Then there begins to appear on the screens, and in the messages coming to them, support for Freya's rash act. Not just one or two messages, but many. A little flood of them, in fact. There are a lot of people on Earth who call themselves Earth Firsters, apparently. The emigration of people, often rich people, off Earth and out into the solar system, and then even out of the solar system, has left behind a great deal of resentment, it seems. Only now are these people paying any attention to a crew of lost starfarers. So now I'm popular? Freya says. They hate me, and I hit someone, and now they like me?
Not the same people, Budden points out, frowning. Or maybe so, I can't tell. But yes, that's Earth for you. That's what I've been trying to tell you. That's how it works here.
I don't like this place.
Badim shakes his head.
You don't like these people. It's not the same thing. And it's not everybody either.
Aram, listening to them, says to Freya,
Ah, don't you see? Since your mind is the prison, you'll live behind bars everywhere now.
So fuck it, let's move to Mars then.
Freya grumbles, remembering the poem, which had pierced her like a sliver.
Definitely not, Badim says, waving a finger. They're stuck in their rooms up there, almost as much as we were on the ship. That place is not much different from Aurora. The problem is chemical rather than biological, and they may amend the soil there over time, but not soon. Centuries at the least. Nope, we're just going to have to get used to it here.
But during the brief disaster of their trip away, six more of them have died. One, a youth, Raoul, was killed in a fight with some person who did not like the idea of them coming back to Earth.
After the memorial services for these six truly sad affairs, Aram tells Badim a story about Shackleton, who got his entire crew safely home from one of his Antarctic misadventures, only to see several get sent to the trenches of the First World War, where they were promptly killed. Freya is already feeling like she wants to hit someone again, and something in this dismal story makes her furious. "What are we going to do?" she shouts at them. "I can't stand this. Just hanging around, getting picked off one by one? No, 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 no. We have to do something. I don't know what, but something. Something to change this place. Something. So, what are we going to do?" Badim nods uneasily. His ancient face is creased with an ancient look, a look Freya recognizes from her childhood. The pursed-lipped frown that always came over his face when he was trying to figure out what to do about Devi. This look had always held tucked within it several things. Amusement, love, worry, annoyance, pride that he had such a problem to solve. His wife, the warrior, on a rampage. Now maybe it's a bit the same. Maybe not. And anyway, Freya is too angry to feel reassured by this. Now it's her he is looking at. And to her, there's nothing amusing about the idea of having in your life a crazy, idealistic person you love and must help. Not when she's the person. Anyway, it's everybody. Lots of the starfarers are like her. It's nothing special. No, fuck it. They need a way to live. Something to do. Or else they'll never be anything but freaks from space, dying one by one from Earth shock. The people from the stations out around Jupiter and Saturn have made up that name for it. They come back from space to Earth to get a dose of bacteria or whatnot. Their sabbatical, they call it. Come back to get sick in order to stay well. But it's a tough thing for them. And they often come down with what they call Earth shock, and sometimes die of it. Actually, some Saturnine people are offering to help them adjust to their new situation, along with the Earth Firsters. "There's a combination for you," Aram remarks. "No, they're freaks, and so only freaks want to help them." Aram begins to study this sabbatical that the space people take. Everyone living out there in the solar system comes back to Earth for a bit of time every several years, if they are concerned to live a full lifespan, which of course almost everyone is. This association between returning to Earth and living longer in space is an unexplained correlation, a statistical phenomenon that no one can test out in their own body, as no one can live both ways. And it isn't necessarily true for every individual that staying in space all the time makes them sick. It's just that, on average, space people who don't return to Earth every 5 to 10 years, for several months to a couple of years, tend to die quite a bit younger than those who do return. The numbers are contested, but the studies, which Aram thinks are mostly pretty well designed, generally agree that the added lifespan for off-planet residents taking Earth sabbaticals is something like 20 years or 30 years. Even now that they are sometimes living up to 2 centuries, that is a long time. It's such a huge discrepancy that most people adhere to what the data suggest and go home to Earth on a personal schedule of some kind. Best to pay attention to the data and not take chances. Studying all this, Aram points out that the true artificial intelligence is the actuarial long-term study. No human could ever see these things. This particular AI has made a compelling case. Suggestive, plausible, persuasive, probable, compelling. Scientists' linguistic scale for evaluating evidence is still the same, Aram says. And it tops out with quite a strong word, really. To compel. People do it because they are compelled to. Reality makes them do it. The urge to live makes them do it. But there is another effect, almost the opposite of the sabbatical, and just as strong, if not stronger.
Earth shock. People come back to Earth, perfectly healthy on arrival, and die of something without warning. Sometimes it can be very difficult to figure out what exactly did it, which adds to the fear of the syndrome, of course. Quick decline, earth shock, teralergenic. These names contain within themselves the terrible news that the phenomenon they refer to is not well understood. An effect with unknown causes. Names like this reveal the ignorance in the name itself. The Big Bang. Cancer. Quick decline. Any disease ending with the suffix itis or penia, etc. So many ignorant names. So the returned starfarers, having missed their own sabbaticals by some 250 years, are now dying of earth shock, it seems. Even when causes can be found for any individual case, it's suspicious that the causes have cropped up so soon after their return. Hard to believe they would have happened in the ship, in hibernation or not. No, something is going on. Something they will either survive, or they won't. Meanwhile, living on this big, crazy planet that still scares Freya out of her wits, what to do? What to do? At this point, she could not be more miserable. A week or more of this misery drags on before Badim comes to her and answers her question, "So what are we going to do?" As if only a second has passed since it burst out of her.
"We go to the beach,"
he announces cheerily.
"What do you mean?" Freya demands. For, of course, there are no beaches. Sea level rose 24 meters in the 22nd and 23rd centuries of the Common Era, because of processes they began in the 21st century that they couldn't later reverse. And in that rise, all of Earth's beaches drowned. Nothing they have done since to chill Earth's climate has done much to bring sea level back down. That will take a few thousand more years. Yes, they are terraforming Earth now. There's no avoiding it, given the damage that's been done. In this, the Common Era year, 2910, they are calling it a 5,000-year project. Some say longer. It'll be a bit of a race with the Martians, they joke. But for now, it's goodbye to the beaches. And indeed, many a celebrated island of yore now lies deep under the waves. An entire world and way of life has disappeared with these fabled places. A lifeway that went right back to the beginning of the species in South and East Africa, where the earliest humans were often intimately involved with the sea. That wet, sandy, tidal, salty, sun-flecked, beautiful beach life, all gone. Along with so much else, of course. Animals, plants, fish. It's part of the mass extinction event that they are still struggling to end, to escape. So much has been lost that will never come back again, that the loss of the joy of the relatively few humans who were lucky enough to live on the strand, who combed the beaches and fished and rode the waves and lay in the sun, that's nothing much to grieve for, given everything else that has been lost. All the suffering, all the hunger, all the death, all the extinctions. Most of the mammal species are gone. Still, it was a way of life much beloved, and still remembered in art and song, image and story. Still legendary. Still a lost golden age, vibrating at some level below thought. There in their salty blood and tears, in the long curled waves of DNA that still break inside them all. So there are people bringing that back. They are bringing the beaches back. These people are one wing or element of the Earth Firsters. Tree huggers, space haters, they're a mixed bag. Many of them renounce not just space, but also the many virtual, simulated, and indoor spaces that so many Terrans seem happy to inhabit. To the Earth Firsters, these people are in effect occupying spaceships on the land, or have moved inside their screens or their heads. So many people stay indoors all the time, it seems crazy to Freya, even though she herself still cowers in the shelter of built spaces every waking moment.
But she has an excuse, she thinks, having been locked in all her life, while the Terrans have no excuse. This place is their home. Their disregard for their natural inheritance, their waste of the gift given them, is part of what causes her to gnash her teeth and drive herself to windows, even into open doorways, there to stand trembling on the threshold, terrified, willing her body to stop clenching, to step out, willing herself to change. Finding in that moment of liminal panic that sometimes you can't make yourself do even the things you most want to do, when fear seizes you by the throat. But these beach lovers are apparently like her in this opinion or belief about how to regard Earth. They are kindred souls, perhaps, and they are expressing their love of that lost world of the seashore by rebuilding it. Freya listens amazed as Badim and Aram bring into their compound a short old woman, brown-skinned, silver-haired, who describes her people and their project.
We do a form of landscape restoration called beach return. It's a kind of landscape art, a game, a religion.
She grins and shrugs.
It's whatever. To do it, we've adapted or developed several technologies and practices, starting with mines, rock grinders, barges, pumps, tubing, scoops, bulldozers, earth movers, all that kind of thing. It's heavy industry at first. A lot of landscape restoration is. We've used this technology all over the world. It involves making arrangements with governments or other landholders to get the rights to do it. It works best in certain stretches of the new coastlines. They're mostly wastelands now, intertidal zones without being suited for that. Being amphibious, she grins, is weird.
They nod. Freya says, so what do you do exactly? In these new tidal zones, the woman explains, they proceed to make beaches that are as similar to those that went away as can be arranged.
We bring them back, that's all. And we love it. We devote our lives to it. It takes a couple of decades to get a new beach started, so any given beach person usually works on only 3 or 4 in a lifetime, depending on how things go. But it's work you can believe in.
Ah, Freya says. It's labor and